This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There is an emerging business model that threatens to overturn the conventional wisdom about how businesses should regard and treat their customers. That means you. If you think the customer is always right, think again. If you believe businesses should provide all of their customers an equal experience, what our guest this hour has to say about that may shock you, because he says only the best customers should get the best treatment. And for the rest of us, well, maybe we don't deserve the best treatment. The concept is called customer centricity, and our guest today has written all about it in his book, Customer Centricity: Focus on the Right Customers for Strategic Advantage. As we head into the busiest time of year for customer-business interaction, we thought we'd delve into this brave new world with the book's author, Dr. Peter Fader, professor of marketing at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and host of Marketing Matters, which is heard once a week, I believe, on Sirius XM Channel 111. It's the Wharton Initiative, Wharton Business Initiative, I believe. It's part of that, correct?
Wharton Business Radio.
Boy, you have the voice for it, too. Say it again.
Wharton Business Radio.
Well,
the face for it, too.
That's right. All this time you've been wasting in the classroom. You should have been a staff announcer, a booth announcer someplace. Thank you for being here.
Nice. It's wonderful to be here with you, Mike.
Let's start with the definition of customer centricity, because at first blush it would sound to me that that would say that the customer would be put in the center of everything, that we'd be the most important thing in the business, but that is not what it means, so define it.
So let's first be real clear on what it isn't. Okay. And exactly as you said, Mike, it's not super-duper customer service. We'll bend over backwards for everybody. If you have even a slightest hiccup in your customer experience, we're on it. Well, it is that, but just for the customers who really do deserve it, the customers who have just so much value locked up in them that if we let them have a bad experience, if we let them say a bad thing about us, if we let any of that value slip away, it's going to really hurt us over the long run.
So how have most businesses been operating up until this theory began to emerge? And I'm assuming that is it a relatively new theory?
Yes and no. Some of these ideas have been around for a long time.
Okay.
If you operate a small store, you have your own, you know, mom and pop coffee shop, you know who those really good customers are. And you have a relationship with them. It's more than just selling coffee. You're going to be offering all kinds of advice about jobs and movies and other local retailers. And you have a real relationship with them. You're willing to invest in those customers because they're going to be so worth it in the long run. Mm. Whereas as other customers walk in, you're not going to treat them badly, but you're not necessarily going to invest in them in the same way as someone who you know has a lot of value.
So customer centricity, I mean, you're from the Wharton Business School, which is a major school for business in the country. When did people like you, PhDs like you, suddenly look in Ma and Pa and say, they're on to something?
It's been pretty recent. For me personally, I've been doing this a long time. So I'm just a numbers guy. I just like predicting things. I like looking at customers doing things over time and saying, what will they do next and for how long and for how much money? So for me, it's not just a theory. It's actually what I've been observing for decades, but it goes against the grain of conventional business thinking. So again, we'll see this on a real small scale, whether it's that mom and pop retail, or if you're a private wealth manager and your customer base consists of five rich people, you know whose call you're going to take at 2 a.m. and who's going to wait until Monday morning. So these ideas that the seeds have been planted for them in lots of sectors for a long time, it's being able to do this at scale when you have millions of customers. That's the new idea that I'm trying to promote.
So if, as you say, this customer centricity is a strategy that aligns development and delivery of a company's products and services with the current and future needs of a select set of customers to maximize their long-term financial value, if that's what it's all about, why call it customer centricity?
You know, it's a great question, Mike, and might be an unfortunate choice of words, because, as you said earlier, people hear that and they say, oh, we're putting the customer right in the middle of everything we do. And I do kind of mean that, except I want to say it this way. We're putting the right customers. See, what customer centricity is a celebration of the differences among our customers. Back in the old days, we had no idea of how customers differed from each other. There was just the customer. Let's just find more of them to buy our product. It was all about that, but they were faceless, nameless entities who were just out there creating demand for the product. But today, we have the granularity, we have the technology to really sort customers out and to understand who are the ones that we want to put at the center and who are the other ones out there who will just, you know, create other demand along the way.
And when you say we have the granularity, that's we now have data.
We have data that was just unimaginable before. I mean, if we go back to the dawn of this the product-centric era, if you think about someone like Henry Ford, he didn't know whether he was selling one car to each of 10 million people or 10 million cars to one person. He didn't know and he didn't care. He was just pushing big hunks of metal out the door and then just leaving it to others to create the demand for them. That's where the marketers came in.
Well, if you're Procter & Gamble and you're making, I don't know, 50 different kinds of soap, but that soap is being sold in grocery stores. That's where the rubber meets the road, it seems. That's where the customer meets the product. They don't meet the product in Cincinnati at Procter & Gamble. So if you're Procter & Gamble, can you use what you're talking about, or is it the grocery store who has to use what you're talking about,
you,
or a combination of
you hit the nail on the head, Mike. So at P&G, they're very, very clear who the customer is. You can go to anyone in that big white building in Cincinnati and say, who is the customer? And they will say without hesitation, it is Walmart or Kroger or Safeway. So for them, the customer is the retailer. But at the same time, they're trying to build relationships with those consumers. Again, in years gone by, they really never knew who those faceless, nameless people were. But today, because of social media and because of being able to track point of sale and track cell phones and so on, you can start to get some visibility into those end users. Mm-hmm. And P&G, like so many other firms in the grocery business, are starting to realize that, you know what, maybe the customer is the person who's actually using the product and not necessarily the entity that we're selling it to. So it's actually causing us to redefine who the customer is.
But haven't they always known that? Because when they advertise their soap, they are putting it on television or in the newspaper or on radio to a person. They're putting it on the, I'm assuming that they're targeting I'm just going to throw a number out. Somebody 18 to 34, probably female, with kids.
Well, that's the problem, is that there's a lot of 18 to 34-year-old females with kids. And so, again, they were doing it in this faceless, nameless way, saying there is just the ambiguous customer out there. And the problem is that there's a tremendous amount of differences even within that demographic sector. Some of them who, for whatever reason, love P&G products, others who, they'll buy them only if it's on sale. So it's being able to appreciate those differences within groups of people, and instead of labeling them just based on their gender or the color of their skin, let's label them on the basis of their economic value to the firm. Let's figure out, regardless of what they look like, those customers who are likely to buy a lot of our stuff and those who will only buy it on occasion.
So it's not so much that they're looking at an 18 to 34 female or man, for that matter, who lives in a house, therefore has access to a washing machine, and who maybe has two kids and makes $75,000 a year. It's more than that.
Is much more than that. Now, let's be clear.
It's not what they make. It's what they buy.
It is what they buy and how much of it. Yes, we want to put people in buckets based on their economic value to the firm. Now, in the old days, all we knew were those demographic descriptors, and so we would use them as a proxy for value, but it's a very, very weak proxy. Look, it was the best we could do in the 1950s and 1960s. But today, again, as we can track people, and a lot of people will self-identify. They will like certain products. They'll talk about them on social media. We could track them through loyalty programs and so on. We can make much more refined statements about who the real customers are.
We have talked on this program a lot about big data, and that's one of the things that we talk about, the fact that you are leaving lots of information about yourself voluntarily on the internet. I just bought a faucet, for instance, for the kitchen, and I registered the faucet with the manufacturer, and now the faucet manufacturer on a weekly basis is sending me surveys, and until I read your book, I did not know, perhaps, that the surveys were doing a lot for them. I thought, you know, I'll take this 5-question survey because I might win $500. But I'm leaving little tidbits about myself all over their web, all over their database. Correct?
Now, to your point of big data skepticism, yes, they're collecting all that. Most of it's useless. So most companies are collecting everything they can because they can, because maybe they'll find something useful in it one day. Most of it's useless. And this goes back to my history, my appreciation of a field that we all love to hate, which is direct marketing. So the direct marketers have been doing this kind of thing for decades, but they've become really smart about which bits are useful and which bits are, you know, nice to know, but we're not going to build our business around it. Mm-hmm. So the real key in this big data era is to know when to say when, to throw away most of that big data, but to identify those key behavioral indicators that will be indicative of what you're worth.
So when we as consumers contribute to the pile of data that continues to mount to the skies, are we doing ourselves any favors? In other words, if customers or if businesses are going to take your advice and really only reward the super good customers who keep coming back and buying more stuff or more expensive stuff, is it helping us to fill out these surveys or to like this company on Facebook or to follow them on Twitter? Is it helping us or is it hurting us as consumers?
For the most part, it's not going to make any difference because most of the things that you do aren't really going to change the way that a company sees you. Now, in the short run, it can hurt, and all of us as consumers have seen the hurt where we look at a pair of pants on some website, and then that pair follows us around the internet for the next
yes,
6 months. So in a way, it's going to hurt us, not in the kind of, you know, creepy, obtrusive thing, but it's going to be kind of annoying, and it might just make you think twice. So it's kind of that casual hurt, but it's also bad business. I think a lot of these companies are wasting the resources to be pushing products in front of people who have either already bought them or they're just really not that interested. The issue is that the technology has gotten way out ahead of our capability to really identify who the right customers are. So we're serving up a lot of these ads, again, because we can, not necessarily because it's going to help us identify and transform the right customers.
I want to go back to the very beginnings of your book and also the way most of us have thought traditionally about how we should be treated as a customer. And you start with Nordstrom. Now, we have Nordstrom here in Charlotte, and Nordstrom is legendary. I mean, legendary for their customer service. I grew up in Washington. When Nordstrom opened in Washington, it was Woodward and Lothrop and the Heck Company and a couple of other major stores that had been around forever. But Nordstrom came in, and everybody was excited because they'd heard about these remarkable things. Like, I've heard a story about a woman who wanted a certain pair of shoes, and she walked into Nordstrom, and they didn't have them. But the guy at Nordstrom knew they had them at Woody's, and he walked down to Woodward and Lothrop and bought the shoes and brought them to Nordstrom for her. You write about this guy coming into a Nordstrom in Alaska with a complaint about a set of tires that he bought. The tires were worn out, and by God, he wanted his money back, and Nordstrom gave him his money back. They don't sell tires at Nordstrom. Now, did they get a customer for life, or were they just being foolish? And you're saying they shouldn't be acting like that at all.
Well, they should be acting that way for the right customers, those who have so much future value locked up in them that an act like this will either unlock some of that value, or our failure to give them money back for the tires they didn't buy from us will destroy that future value. So for the right customer, yes, we'll give you double the money back on the tires you didn't buy from us. But the problem is we all believe in 80-20 rules, the idea that very few of our customers are the really valuable ones, and most of them are so-so. The problem is if a random customer walks in with the set of used tires, they're probably not a really valuable customer. And if we were to, you know, politely, you know, tell them to leave, we're not going to be losing much in the process. So Nordstrom needs to be – if they want to be customer-centric, they need to be able to pick and choose to say which customers are the ones that will walk across the street to our competitor, get the shoes for, and which ones, we have something else for you instead if you'd like it.
We're going to ruin Nordstrom today. I hate to say it because we're going to come back and talk more about that. So Nordstrom, do not take any – don't give any money out today for tires. Just don't do it. make a policy in Charlotte today. Don't do it. Peter Fader's our guest. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and TRCW, a woman's specialty retailer providing distinctive clothing, sportswear, and accessories for women from European and American designers, chosen for quality, style, and functionality. Located in Phillips Place, details at trcstyle.com. I know it's not quite Thanksgiving, but we're about to hear about the biggest Christmas event in the country, the 47th edition of the Southern Christmas Show, which makes Charlotte its home. It's grown over the years, and we'll speak to the founders about why this has happened and about its economic impact on Charlotte as well. And then a conversation with one of the most prolific Iranian writers in the world, who happens to be a woman. She is among a number of emerging female writers in the Middle East, bringing a new perspective to that part of the world. And she joins us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama is expected to announce an executive order that would protect millions of unauthorized immigrants from deportation. GOP lawmakers say they'll block the president's order. Political repercussions of White House action on immigration.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins in our Spirit Square studio today. Peter Fader, who is a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and the author of what we're talking about this morning, Customer Centricity, Focus on the Right Customers for Strategic Advantage. It kind of puts everything you've thought about what you how you should be treated as a customer, and if you're in business, how you should treat customers, kind of puts it up on its ear a little bit. We were talking about Nordstrom before the break. I have a warm spot in my heart for them. I can't afford to buy a lot of stuff there. But when I go, they really treat you royally. You buy a sport coat or a suit or a pair of pants, and they come around the counter after you've paid for it to hand them to you. They don't put it over the counter, and they tie everything up with little ribbons. It's really very nice. Should Nordstrom back away from those habits? I mean, because I don't go there very often, because I can't afford to go there very often.
So. I love Nordstrom myself. I've spent tens of thousands of dollars there a year. I love how I'm treated.
I want to be you.
or my wife, for that matter. But here's the difference. I am not suggesting that every firm needs to be doing the pick and choose customer centric thing. The more traditional way of doing business, really, which is how Nordstrom is, their strategy is, let's be the best. Mm-hmm. So let's either sell the very best product or let's sell it in the very best way. So whether you're an Apple, you're a BMW, you're a Four Seasons hotel, you know, being a product leader or a service leader, that's what Nordstrom is. They're the best at what they do. That's just a different strategy. And in no way am I saying that that's the wrong strategy. If you are the best, then you should play to your strength. But if you're a firm where it's a little bit harder to compete, then it behooves you to pick and choose and say, let's just figure out who the right customers are for us, because we can't win them all.
Nordstrom seems to have taken a page from the small business playbook that you talk about, and that is they treat people, no matter who they are, as well as they possibly can. They really give them great customer service and treatment when you're in the store. But you're saying that you should really only provide that to people who are really your most valuable customers. So are they doing it the wrong way? I mean, explain this to me, because you're saying that business should adopt the practices of Ma and Pa, and that seems like a Ma and Pa practice to me.
And so what's happening is the bar on customer centricity has been going up, up, up. As consumer expectations increase, as companies' ability to deliver service increases. So the, you know, returning the product, the walking around the counter with the bag, that's now table stakes. But you look at what a Nordstrom, and not just Nordstrom, but Neiman Marcus and others, what they're doing now, where they will have their insider program, and you will have your personal shopper, and they will invite you to special events. So Nordstrom is doing a lot of the kinds of things that I'm advocating, where they're going to be, you know, nice to everybody, but they're going to be super duper nice and really be a trusted advisor to those select customers who have lots of future value in them.
And you say, if I understand this correctly, that the reason we're shifting into this direction is that it's becoming increasingly difficult today to come up with a blockbuster product or a blockbuster service. And so now you've got to change the way you do business. Let's talk about Apple, because that's a cult. and they do have blockbuster products. You know, the iPhone, the iPad, the MacBook Air. I mean, they're blockbuster products. But they also have these stores where you go in and it's like going into Disney World or something. I mean, people stay there and they just want to be around other people who are into the Apple world. How should Apple be conducting themselves?
So Apple is the exception to the rule. They're about the only company left on the planet where people will line up around the block a week in advance to buy one of their products. I mean, that's the way it used to be for all companies, that we're about to launch the new product. You know, if you're good and you follow our rules, we will let you have it. Companies used to control the conversation like that and launch the new products were really big events. For most companies now, as soon as they launch a product, they know that their competitors are going to launch something as good, and they know that the customers are controlling a conversation in a way that they find uncomfortable. So Apple's the exception. Again, Apple is a product leader, just as Nordstrom is on the service side. Apple's one of the few companies that can get away with saying, we're going to do it on our terms. And if you like it, you're going to have to buy it our way. So they're not necessarily – well, on one hand, that they are the paragon. Everyone would like to be Apple. Few companies have the capability to do so. And so other companies need to adapt. While the Apples are out there leading the way, we have to figure out ways to work around them using different kinds of strategies.
So if you adopt this customer-centric approach and you start – you identify who your best customers are or you predict – who they will be as you go forward into the future, and your predictions are right. How do you treat the rest of the customers? If you treat them, if you super serve the great ones, what do you do to the rest of us?
Excellent question. So some people sometimes get the wrong impression that I'm saying get rid of them. Of course, no, that's a terrible idea. You actually need all those so-so customers out there, partially because there's so many of them. So the collective value of those customers, it might be limited for any one of them, but collectively those so-so customers are worth a lot. And so we really need them to keep the lights on. The difference is when we're coming up with a new product, we're not necessarily going to come up with something that will be as broadly appealing as possible. We want to come up with something that's going to make those valuable customers even more valuable. And if it trickles down and some of the so-so customers want to buy it too, that's great. We're happy to do that. So we need to have a healthy relationship with them, but it needs to be more on kind of operationally efficient terms. Yes, we're glad to sell you stuff. But frankly, don't expect the same kind of service as these great customers.
But then how do you – because I would think that your goal should be to take these also-ran customers and somehow convert them into the best customers. So if you're going to treat them like, how do you ever convert them?
That is the real key and maybe the most provocative statement in my book and in my worldview, which is companies are out there all the time trying to take those so-so customers and transform them, take the ugly ducklings and turn them into swans. Turns out that's really hard to do.
Yeah.
That for the most
particularly
part –
particularly if you're mistreating them, doctor.
But even if you just have this casual relationship with them and they buy from you once a year, mm-hmm. it's going to be really hard to turn them into that locked-in, run-through-the-gates-of-hell-to-stay-with-you loyal customers. It's really hard to do that. You're better off trying to figure out – what makes our valuable customers different than the less valuable ones, and how can we find more like them, ones who were born to be good?
What if, as an also-ran, I like your company, I like your products, I come there a lot. Maybe I'm not your best customer, but then I find out that my next-door neighbor is one of your best customers, and he starts telling me at the backyard barbecue what your store, your company has done for him. And I'm going, they don't do that for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what happens then?
Yeah, we have these notions of fairness here in the U.S. in particular, where exactly that kind of thing, that everyone should be treated the same, everyone should pay the same. What's interesting about that is that that's kind of unnatural. And if you go shopping in other parts of the world, you go to the Grand Bazaar in Istanbul, you know that you're going to be paying a different amount for the same leather jacket as the person in front of you in line or behind you in line. It's okay. You know, the person there sizes you up and says, tourist, we'll charge you more. So part of business is indeed sizing up the customer, not necessarily in terms of what they're willing to pay, but what they're worth to us in terms of a relationship.
And we really aren't used to this in America, except when we buy cars, where we have been dickering. Normally, you walk into a store, the price is the price. There's no negotiation, although that during the recession, if you were smart, you could get the price down. That doesn't happen so much in America, but it does happen all the time online, and we don't know it.
That's right. And so the online merchants are able to treat customers differently. The technology enables that. That's one of the big reasons why I'm pushing these ideas now. You look at a company like Amazon, they're just brilliant at this. And it's not just the pricing, but it's the service itself. It's the selection. It's even things like the free shipping and the customer service, which will differ from one customer to another. And at first, you know, you'll have that backyard barbecue conversation, and at first it kind of rubs you the wrong way. But as long as they can justify it, as long as there's a good reason why, that it's not done in an arbitrary way, that it's done because we recognize that some customers are truly better than others.
So you're not saying to mistreat the customers who are not your best customers. You just don't give them all the perks, perhaps.
That is right. We need as many customers as we can get. We're just going to treat some a little better than others, not worse than others.
So if customer centricity means being friendly to everyone, providing good products to everyone, providing good service to everyone, what then do you do for the best customers? How do you set them apart? What am I getting if I'm a great customer?
That's exactly it. So, and again, let's put aside pricing, but very often it's going to be you're going to get a different phone number to call when you have a problem, and a real person's going to pick it up. You're going to be invited to certain kinds of events. The company's going to make all kinds of suggestions, not just about their products and services, but here's other products you should consider buying or other activities that you should consider doing. So the centricity part of it is that we're going to surround those valuable customers with a variety of products and services and experiences to show them that we're in it for the long run. We're not just here to sell you stuff, but we want to develop a real meaningful relationship with you that's going to be mutually beneficial.
Is this difficult to do? Is this difficult for companies to figure out how to do it?
It's difficult for them to figure out who the right customers are. In other words, being able to look into the future and say, I think this one's going to be more valuable than that one. That's something that previously was impossible because we just didn't have the data or the analytical capabilities or the technology to treat them differently. It's becoming a lot easier today, and in fact, it's becoming more of a competitive imperative today. So the most difficult part today is the culture, that so many companies are so deeply inbred with product centricity. It's all about just selling the product to whoever will buy it. That for them to shift to such a radically different strategy, which requires different mindsets, different metrics, different incentives for the employees, that's the hard part.
I'm not sure you can answer this question, but can you give me an example or a couple of examples of companies that are still doing it the old way, just selling the product to whomever can buy it, versus the companies who are doing it with customer centricity?
Sure thing. Well, you know, right here in Charlotte, we see some amazing examples of the transformation taking place. If you look at three of the biggest sectors here, banking and healthcare and energy, all of them great examples, because in the old days, which is to say a generation ago, a lot of these were heavily regulated. They had kind of virtual monopoly status, and so they could just sort of sit back and come up with a new product whenever they wanted, and people were more or less forced to buy from them. They didn't really have to worry about who the customer was or how they differed from each other. It was life was easy for them. But now that things are just much more competitive and they have just a lot of really nimble firms here and from other areas nipping at their heels, it becomes harder to innovate. And so a lot of companies with kind of, you know, legacy monopoly power have been fortunate in the past to be able to sit back and then produce things on their own. But today, because of both the opportunities and the challenges of business as usual, they're forced to, or at least they're strongly encouraged to start to figure out how those customers are different from each other and which ones do we really want to build the business around.
But you're not going to name any names, are you? I can tell.
Oh, it's easy to name names.
Okay.
In fact, if let's go back to those companies that are the product leaders.
Okay.
So whether it's the Apple, whether it's the BMW, companies like that, or other companies that are so amazingly operationally efficient. So a company like a Walmart, a McDonald's, they're just so good at turning the crank and pushing stuff out the door that for them to have a loyalty program, for them to do the kind of pick and choose thing we're talking about, would actually be really inefficient for them. So for most companies, this customer centricity stuff doesn't make sense. But for some of these companies on the margin that can't compete as well on being the best or being the most efficient, it might be the best way to go.
There are a lot of customer loyalty programs. I just want to bring out my keychain here. I have a hardware store loyalty card. I have a office supply loyalty card. I have a bookstore loyalty card. I have several grocery store loyalty cards. I have a big box electronics store loyalty card. I have a pharmacy loyalty card. Is it helping me to use these cards in any way as a customer, except by voluntarily giving them the ability to connect everything I buy from them to me?
Well, again, this is an example where the technology is out in front of the strategy. And all those companies, well, I don't want to pick anyone in particular, they're building these loyalty programs because, A, they can, and, B, because everybody else is. And those are bad reasons. I'd like to have this kind of customer-centric strategy in place and then use the loyalty program to help identify who those best customers are and as a mechanism to serve them differently. Most companies are still using loyalty programs just to sell stuff to the customer. In fact, a lot of retailers are kind of choking on those loyalty programs. They had this mentality, you know, if we build it, they will come. If we have our loyalty program, we'll wave our magic wand, and those great customers will just naturally separate themselves out. It's not that simple. And so a lot of companies have actually been pulling back from the loyalty programs, dropping them completely. The overhead on these things is high. So unless you know what you're going to do with the data before you get it, it's probably not going to have a good return on the big investment required.
Let me share some questions that have come in while we've been talking. A Twitter question: as a customer, what makes you loyal to a company or brand? And if you're a business owner, what do you do to cater to your core customers? Well, we're actually tweeting that out to our listeners on Twitter right now. But you answer the question: as a business owner, what do you do to cater to your core?
Yeah. So one of the really important tenets of customer centricity is to be able to identify true loyalty, those customers who really love us, versus the ones who are either forced to stay with us because their switching costs are so high. Mm-hmm. They're not thrilled with us, but the alternative or finding alternative would be worse.
You're talking about banking now, aren't you?
I'm talking about a lot of industries. For most people, when I mention this, they're thinking telecom.
Okay.
That they're held hostage by their service provider. Right. The service provider thinks that they're loyal. Look, you've been with us for 10 years. So part of it is the necessity for us to sort out true loyalty from some kind of spurious loyalty. And again, the data that we have, our ability to look below the surface of the data instead of saying, oh, you've been here for 10 years, can we actually see that you've been advocating on our behalf? Can we see that you've actually been referring customers to us? Or can we see that you've been complaining all the time and you can't wait to get out? So if we can sort out true loyalty and then figure out how those truly loyal customers are different from the ones who are just along for the ride, that's where the key to success is.
So if you're a business, you may have a slightly different perspective on this. And if you are a business owner, what do you do to cater to your core customers? If you're a customer, what makes you loyal to a company or a brand? You can tweet us your comments at WFAE. John emails, I would like to know whether Professor Fader believes this could work for small businesses. I own a rapidly growing home cleaning business, and we routinely rank our customers by economic value. However, it is the small customers that do not provide a lot of value that will write terrible reviews online in forums like Angie's List that could have devastating effects on overall growth. How can this be handled?
So first of all, John, it's a great issue, and what you're experiencing is true for so many other folks. A small business, let's put aside those ratings and reviews just for a moment, but definitely want to talk about them. Many small businesses are born around this idea that we figure out who those great customers are and we grow through them. But then as you grow and grow and grow and you go from tens to hundreds to thousands of customers, then it all goes away. And then it just becomes here comes a customer. Let's serve them. And we can't sort them out as well as we used to. We can't rank them like we used to. I want to teach companies that you can continue to do that because the data is out there, the kinds of models and technology to come up with this idea of customer lifetime value. It is now possible to do that at scale, so you don't have to lose that good feeling of who those good customers are. But I do want to talk more about the ratings and reviews and their role in it. We'll come back to that.
Yes, we will, because you're a professional and you do this on SiriusXM. You know when the break is coming, and it's here. Peter Fader, professor of marketing at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Customer centricity is what we're talking about, and we're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, blood supplier to 27 of the region's hospitals. Only donors can meet the area's constant need for blood. CBCC.org. U.S. President Obama is expected to announce an executive order that would protect millions of unauthorized immigrants from deportation. Republican lawmakers say that they will block the president's order, and they will take a look at the political repercussions of White House action on immigration coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you're a business owner, and you're hearing this and you're going, what? What am I missing here? Well, join us, Charlotte Talks, at WFAE.org, or you can search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
I'm Silvia Poldroli. In Italy, we treat our cars like family. They stand by us and give us years of loyal service, no matter how many Roman relics we sideswipe. So when it's time to say ciao bella to your old car, donate it to us. You'll get a tax break and we'll tow it away free. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Donate your car through the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program. Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dr. Peter Fader about his book, Customer Centricity, Focus on the Right Customers for Strategic Advantage. And we were responding to a question from an email about small versus large customers and how bad reviews from small customers on say places like Angie's List can be devastating and may not be fair, may not be accurate. Maybe somebody grinding an axe, not getting the service that they didn't pay for, but they still wanted that service. Talk about that. What do you do about that?
So all these ratings and reviews, first of all, it's a great example of where we can see customers, we can understand them. We have visibility that we just wouldn't have had before. I mean, before it would have been a casual conversation on the street, but it wouldn't be heard by thousands or millions of other people. So we need to put ratings and reviews into perspective. That again, on one hand, it can be just a great source of data to really understand how we're doing. But it's also a problem with it because, as you know, one bad review can go a long way. Thing is, this is such a new idea, and I think right now people are so sensitive to those bad reviews that they're often overreacting. You see that bad review in there, and you figure, oh, I got to do something about it. Or as a consumer, you see a bad review and say, I'll never go there. Slowly but surely, or I might even say rapidly, we're becoming somewhat desensitized to them. We recognize that any time we launch a product or service, that there's always going to be some spread. There's going to be some who love us and some who don't. And that's just part of doing business. It's not the need to cater to every single one.
The other thing I think, this is from personal experience, that perhaps people in business who have not been exposed to criticism as often as those of us in the media have to come to understand, and I guess you understand it quickly after reviews go up on various websites about your product, it is the people who had a negative experience or people who don't like something about what you're doing who will most often express themselves. It will not be people who had a great time or who love you because they just don't feel the need to tell the world about that. So it's the negative stuff that's going to stick out.
That is right. And so as we get a greater visibility into who our customer base is, not this faceless, nameless customer, but this range of customers, we come to accept it. We come to accept that some are going to be terrific and maybe quiet about it, and some are going to not be terrific and they're going to be noisy about it. I think many folks might be familiar with the notion of net promoter score. You go to a restaurant or a car repair place, and they ask you that question: would you recommend us to a friend or family member? And now NPS, Net Promoter Score, has taken the world by storm. Let's put people in buckets. Those who give us a 9 or a 10, yes, I'll recommend you. Let's call them promoters. Let's give those people who are a 0 through 6, let's call those detractors. And then you have those kind of silent ones in the middle. And the idea of net promoter score is, let's take the difference between the promoters, the 9s and the 10s, minus the detractors, the 0s through 6s, and that net promoter score is going to be an overall indication of how we're doing. The point is that we don't have to please everyone. We recognize that there are going to be some detractors out there, but as long as we can keep that number relatively small, and as long as we can keep the number at the high end relatively large, we're doing okay. So it's a recognition that our customers are going to be different from each other and learn to live with it. And as I said before, we can't necessarily expect to turn all those detractors into promoters. We can try, but it's going to be expensive to do so, and we might be better off just finding more promoters in the first place and just living with the detractors.
You offer four tenets of customer centricity. Understand the fundamental differences among your customers. Understand there is quantifiable value to be found in individual customers on whom you can focus your marketing efforts to generate the greatest long-term value. Learn how much you should spend to keep an existing customer versus how much to acquire a new one, and leverage customer data to serve customers in a more personalized manner. There's a lot of stuff in those four tenets. How do you do them all?
It is tough. And part of it is because it's so different than the traditional product-centric, let's sell the product to everybody way of doing business. In fact, let's take the third point there as one that really shows how different this mindset is.
Learn how much you should spend to keep an existing customer versus how much it costs to acquire.
Exactly. So everybody's out there saying it costs so much more to acquire a new customer than to retain one, so you got to focus on the customers that you have. Now, that's a true statement. It is more expensive to acquire than to retain, but it's missing the point. The point is, if you have this customer who's just constantly complaining and they want that discount and they want that special treatment, but they're not worth that much to you, just because it's cheaper to keep them around, you might be better off going fishing for a new customer.
Fire the customer.
I'm not saying fire the customer, but have a relationship with them that's going to be on our terms instead of their terms. Say that this is as much as I'm going to give you, and I'm willing, because I've become smart now and I know how my good customers are different from my not-so-good customers, I'm going to get a little bit smarter about where I'm going to throw the nets out to acquire new customers. And the chances are that the next one I get might be better than this one that I have. Let me focus on the value that the customers provide instead of the cost of obtaining or retaining them.
So to do this, you have to understand the customer on the granular level. You have to get real serious data about this customer. But you are the co-director of the Wharton Customer Analytics Initiative. That's what it all boils down to. But you've also said that too much information is being captured in order to answer questions that don't require it. So to understand the customer on a granular level, what questions should be asked? What do you have to know?
I want to make it real specific and real tangible. I don't want to dance around that really important question. I'm going to go back to our forefathers in direct marketing, who years ago, they were the first ones to actually tag and track their customers and project their value and customize the offerings around them. Let's forget about the products they sell, but let's look at those core business practices. And they looked at all of the data that they were collecting about their customers, and they learned the wonderful rubric of RFM. Recency, frequency, monetary value.
Okay.
You tell me the last time that this customer bought from me. You tell me how many purchases they've made over, say, the last 2 years, and the average size of those purchases. You give me recency, frequency, monetary value. Don't give me the rest of it. I don't need to know who they're talking to. I don't need to know what products they're returning. I mean, all that stuff is nice to know. But you give me those three key metrics, which are easy to get and not particularly creepy at all, and I can make a really accurate statement about what this customer or customers who share similar RFM characteristics will be worth. That's the key, and that this is true for big businesses and small, domestic and international, B2B and B2C. Start with RFM and use that as a way to start to sort out the good customers from the so-so.
Okay. Let's go back to our things that have been coming in on Twitter and Facebook and email, etc. Jonathan responded to our Twitter question. To become a loyal customer, he looks for a total experience. Can be shopping, quality, even packaging.
Indeed. So it's more than just purchasing. So that's the beautiful thing of the data that we can track, of the services that we can offer, of the experiences we can deliver. We can see how customers are interacting with us in so many ways. And in some cases, the fact that they're making transactions, obviously that's a good thing, but that might be trumped by other things. So for instance, in the financial services space, it's becoming increasingly clear that customer referrals are so important. They're so valuable. The customers who come in by referral are so much more valuable than customers who we acquire just through our usual ad campaigns. So we want to find customers who are just really good or willing to make referrals. They're going to be worth as much to us as those who are making lots of purchases.
Peter on Twitter, how should banks be leveraging customer centricity? Can you leverage customer centricity?
Absolutely. Okay. I love to see what's going on in the retail banking world, because there are some who are going to continue to be, you know, we're just the best. We're going to deliver you just great service to everybody, or we're going to give you great rates or a wide variety of products. But there are others, and I'm happy to single out Wells Fargo as a company that really gets this, that they understand that that one indication of customer centricity are how many different kinds of services does each customer have with them. So how many different accounts do they have, or how many different technologies or apps or whatever do they use? And they're going to use that both to sort out who those good customers are and as a basis to figure out who are the new ones we should be going after. And to their credit, this is the real key here. It's not just the marketing people who are looking around and saying, oh, here's the good customers and here's the not so good ones. It's the CEO. I mean, he understands this idea of customer development and how critical that is. So we're seeing lots of good examples. Again, banking, we're seeing it in healthcare and even energy, where companies are emerging from a different era to start to sort customers out and make that the basis of their overall strategy.
Ada emails, airlines in the U.S. have a pretty bad rap for customer service, but they keep shooting themselves in the foot. We discovered this summer that if we look for the same flight repeatedly from the same internet browser, the price kept going up. If we switched to a different browser, or clear your cookies and your cash, when we were ready to actually purchase the tickets, we got a much lower price. This seems really underhanded, but from what I'm hearing on your show this morning, it is par for the course with online shopping. It's so disconcerting because it seems really hard to keep up with how to really avoid this kind of treatment, whether it's personal or impersonal.
I have the ultimate love-hate relationship with the airlines. I don't do work with any of them, but on one hand, they brought loyalty programs as we know it to the forefront. They've done things with dynamic pricing, as you said, and so many of us have experienced. They've done a lot of tactics that would be associated with customer centricity, but on a strategic level, they're not real good at it. They're not doing a great job of surrounding those valuable customers with a wide variety of products and services to enhance that value. Part of it is it's just such a dog-eat-dog competitive business. It's harder for them to do it than it is for a regular retailer. But to that specific point about offering different prices, now, I'm not necessarily saying the airlines are doing it well, but I think this is a really important issue, that the customers are starting to get used to that idea. As a specific example, I'm doing a lot of work with Major League Baseball and helping both the league and the clubs figure out how to be customer-centric. And part of that is going to be through pricing. Part of that's going to be through loyalty programs. Part of that's going to be through surrounding them with lots of other activities in and outside the ballpark to show the valuable ones that we really love them. So this idea of dynamic pricing, charging different amounts for the same seat, you know, as we get closer to the game. You know, at first, a lot of fans said, oh, this is terrible. A lot of clubs refused to do it. But now most of the clubs are doing it. And as long as you're doing it on a good basis, we're not trying to single you out as a person. We're just trying to recognize that, Madison Bumgarner's pitching. You should pay more for that ticket.
Yeah. It's like the new toll lanes they're proposing on 74 and I-77 North. If there's more traffic, then they will charge more money. All right, D emails, Lands End has the following guarantee. Guaranteed, period. As a former supplier to Lands End, I had a chance to ask the president of that firm how they could make that kind of blanket promise. His answer was, the vast majority of our customers have the proper quality expectations and just know when the quality is off. So very few take advantage of Lands End's policy. Some do, but they are so few, we just accommodate them. Is that part of customer centricity, or is that the old way?
That's the old way. That's product leadership. We are just the best at what we do, and we're going to stand by it, and we're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that the customer recognizes.
Would you advocate they change that approach?
Absolutely would advocate that they change the approach. I would say that they should give that, you know, no questions asked guarantee to members of the loyalty program. Sign up for the loyalty program, and if you buy through the program, we'll give you that lifetime guarantee.
Wow.
And if you don't, we're not going to treat you badly. We'll still give you a year or something like that. But let's encourage them to self-select, to self-identify. so that, again, that we don't want to spam them with offers, but just to help us really sort out and reward who the really good customers are.
Bart, on Twitter, how can a business possibly disseminate these practices all the way through the organization, through the lower range of employees?
Bart, that's a great question. Again, that's, I think, the bigger challenge than collecting and using the data. So part of it is it's a completely different mindset. It's not enough just to hang a banner in the employee lunchroom saying, we're now customer-centric. We need different kinds of incentives. As a very specific example, instead of rewarding our salespeople on the basis of how much stuff they sold last quarter, let's reward them on how much they elevated the value of the customers. So, you know, maybe this customer didn't buy anything from us, but they took our call, they played some golf with us. It looks like we're priming them to become a more valuable customer. Well, I'm going to reward the salesperson for elevating that relationship, even if they didn't book any business right now. So there's a lot of things, whether it's the way we set up the organization, the way we incent people, the way we talk about it, that can be done, and we're starting to see examples of it.
Does this approach work equally well on the retail versus the wholesale level?
It's easier on the retail side simply because we can tag and track the customers. We can be direct marketers. On the wholesale side, it's a little bit trickier because, indeed, we can do that with our distributors, but there's that end user down the other end. So again, back to the P&G example, we're starting to see some companies that are trying to be direct marketers in addition to being distributors. So we're seeing it there. But a great example that I've seen through a number of leading companies is the idea of paying it forward. Let's teach our downstream distribution partners how they can and should be customer-centric with their customers. So if we can teach them the tenets of customer centricity, then not only will they do their business better, but they will see us as a more trusted advisor, that we have their best interests in mind. And so they'll have a better appreciation of the tactics that we're using as well. So pay it forward to your customers, and it's going to make it easier to do customer-centric business with them in the process.
Andy writes, great topic. As a small business owner, I can say that it's so important for me to understand my customers and delight them with every interaction due to the reality that a lot of times the extremes are what make it out into public perception. Plus, if you have a loyal customer, you've got a built-in market research pool. In musical instruments, I guess that's his business, customer loyalty is paramount. If a business were to switch to your way of doing business, what would I, as a customer, notice?
Well, you'll notice that there might be some differences in the kinds of products and services that the company is selling. So instead of trying to sell everything to everybody, we want to pivot the products that we're developing and selling around the better customer. So you might notice that it's a little bit more narrowing in the range of products that are offered. And indeed, you might notice differential service. And those who are the best will be treated the best.
Dr. Peter Fader, professor of marketing at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and the author of Customer Centricity, Focus on the Right Customers for Strategic Advantage. Thanks for the hour.
Great spending time with you, Mike.